Hi, dear listeners. I just want to remind you that Undisclosed began its Patreon page. We now have our second episode up. It's a bonus episode where Susan Cullen and I talk about the new season of Serial. And in our first episode, we covered the case of Curtis Flowers, Estate versus Curtis Flowers, which was featured in the second season of In the Dark. So check out these episodes. Sign up to become a patron today of Undisclosed in order to support our work and also to get some great content. And every month, at least, if not more frequently, we'll be dropping bonus episodes and doing maybe some updates on other cases that we have been covering the last few years. To sign up and become a patron for as little as $5 a month, all you have to do is go to www.patreon, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Once again, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Thank you so much for your support and for listening.
Every time I read the transcripts we have from Dennis Perry's trial, I feel the same rush of confusion I felt the very first time I read through them. What? How? Why? Seriously, how could this have possibly resulted in a conviction? In most cases, even cases where I believe there is overwhelming evidence that there's been a wrongful conviction, I don't have trouble understanding the decision the jury made. Even where I disagree with the result, even where I think the jury made the wrong call based on the evidence they had before them, I usually can still trace the path they took to get from where they started to where they ended up. I get it. In Dennis Perry's case, I didn't get it. After I looked over Dennis's case for the very first time, I called Christina Cribbs, who'd worked on his case when she was an attorney at the Georgia Innocence Project. She gave me more background on the case and more info when it happened, but mostly, I just kept asking her the same question over and over again.
But why'd they convict him? I'm still not even seeing, like, the...
I don't know! I wish I could answer that question! I don't know!
There's usually something that...
I know!
There's just nothing there, it feels like. And certainly nothing there that could have proven his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Heck, I'd struggle to even understand how someone could believe the prosecution had met the preponderance standard here. That the state had actually pushed this mess of a case over the 50% threshold to show merely that it was more likely than not Dennis had done it. And reasonable doubt requires so, so much more than that. So why? Why convict him? Christina Cribbs didn't have the answer, and neither did the case file. There were only 12 people who could answer that question, and I would need to hear from them.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 16 of The State versus Dennis Perry. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of a non-story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
When you're juggling a million things, it is hard to have the time to plan your meals, to get the groceries you need for it, to do all the prep required. It takes a lot of time and effort, but now you can let Blue Apron do all of the work for you. This is how Blue Apron works. You choose chef-designed recipes, and they deliver right to your door fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients, and you can cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes. The reason you can cook your dinner so quickly is because you get perfectly proportioned ingredients that are packaged in these nice little packets. You just open them up, put them together, beautiful recipe cards. It's so easy. You skip all the meal planning and you get right to your delicious gourmet meal. And they've got a range of recipes bursting with flavor. I mean, these are recipes I have a very limited rotation and I have just expanded, and my family loves it. I've expanded like all the kinds of things I'm cooking thanks to Blue Apron. Blue Apron lets you choose from all kinds of different recipes, all these gourmet recipes. They're chef designed, restaurant quality meals. So for example, this month, they've got a smoky chicken and sweet potato bake. I mean, it is perfect for fall. They have a homestyle beef medallion and maple pan sauce recipe, beef and broccoli and cumin spice sauce. I love me some cumin. I love cumin. And a hearty vegetable grain bowl, which was delicious. I love the vegetable bowl. I'm eating a lot more veggies and grains nowadays. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free. You're getting the meals for free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's blueapron.com/undisclosed to get your first three meals for free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Between myself and the Georgia Innocence Project, we've now spoken to most of the jurors in Dennis's case. And those jurors, with one exception, are all very certain that Dennis Perry shot and killed Harold and Thelma Swain. The jurors, with one exception, did not express concern to us about the verdict they'd reached. They were confident in what they decided. That one exception, though, is Donna Turner.
I cannot say that all of us walked out of there feeling like that justice was really served. I felt, odds are, he was probably present, but did he do it? No. I just don't believe he did it.
Many of the jurors were willing to talk to us at length about their experiences in serving on the jury in this case, but only Donna Turner was willing to be recorded, which means even though she's the only juror you'll be hearing from directly in this episode, don't assume what she says is necessarily a representative sample of how the other jurors in this case felt. Because often it isn't. And most of the jurors in this case felt more like this.
I was saying it was a very, very cut and dry case.
That's GIP intern Ed Kostikian giving an update on his interview with one of the jurors in this case. At the time, we were all down in Brunswick. Christina Cribbs and I spent the day out in Camden County looking for witnesses, while Ed and GIP director Claire Gilbert had been in Glynn County talking to jurors. And that evening, we'd all met up for dinner, discuss how our days had gone.
We were both very much just left with this sort of depressive feeling that it doesn't matter who was on trial, just the fact that someone was on trial meant that they did it with him, you know?
All of the jurors that Claire and Ed had spoken to that day had been willing to talk to them about the case, but many of them seemed confused about why exactly anyone would be interested in reinvestigating this case in particular. I mean, the guy was clearly guilty. Although at least one of the jurors Ed and Claire spoke to that day wasn't quite as convinced in his belief of Dennis Perry's guilt.
He just had a sense that if you had to weigh the two, the prosecution had a little bit stronger of a case.
Yeah, that's usually the standard, so it's fine.
And
just a little bit stronger. Good.
And the defense really didn't do a great job sort of proving that he didn't do it. And yeah, it was. And that he, but I hesitate in saying this on tape because he was really, I mean, he recognized that was wrong. He was like, you know, if it were my own kid, I would have paid more attention, but I didn't know this guy, and I just started this job, and I just wanted it to be over.
While the jurors had a unified belief in Dennis Perry's guilt, they were anything but unified in their beliefs about how and why this crime had actually been committed. And different jurors have been convinced of his guilt for very different reasons. For example, one of the jurors Ed and Claire spoke to had three big reasons for why he thought Dennis Perry was guilty. The first and foremost of those reasons all went back to that oval photo from Jane Beaver.
In talking to him, the thing that he seemed to have focused most on was the composite, and he pressed very much that he felt like the composite was identical to Dennis Perry, and like he said at one point, like if you had like had him in front of you and drawn a picture, you couldn't have made it any more identical.
It wasn't just the composite, though. That juror had two more reasons.
The first was the composite. The second was the fire breaks.
Oh, yeah.
So what's the third one?
He believed very much in the story about Dennis Perry having a beef with the deacon and having asked him for money. And he repeated the phrase like a number of times, like, that Dennis Perry had said, like, I want to kill me in N-word.
For this juror, those three things added up to guilt. The composite, the fire breaks, and Jane Beaver's story. And if you're wondering what a fire break is and how they possibly could have come up in the context of the case, well, we'll get to that later in this episode. But for now, to understand why the jurors reached the verdict that they did, we have to go back to the very start. Back to February 10, 2003, when Dennis Perry's trial began in Glynn County Superior Court.
Recently, GIP hired a new attorney, and she's taken over Dennis Perry's case. Jennifer Whitfield has spent the last 4 years as a prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Georgia. But in October, she joined the Georgia Innocence Project and has spent the last few weeks getting immersed in the Perry case.
So when you first read the transcripts in Dennis's case, what was your impression, or what do you think of it?
Well, it's hard because we don't have the full transcript. So, for example, not having closing statements makes it really difficult to understand what the jury took away from the trial. It's also really hard to tell what evidence was admitted and what evidence wasn't admitted because we don't have all of the judge's decisions on those questions. And so it's not entirely clear what evidence was ultimately presented to or shown to the jury. But all that said, I was stunned that he was convicted.
After Dennis Perry's conviction, he tried to obtain the full transcripts from his trial. He had new post-conviction counsel, and as an indigent defendant, he normally would have been entitled to have a copy of those transcripts paid for by the state. In this case, though, Judge Williams said, wait, hold up. Before the state will pay for this transcript, you'll have to prove to me first that you're going to use those transcripts to file a motion that actually has some kind of merit. Dennis Perry, through his counsel, told the court he intended to file a habeas petition raising three grounds for relief. First, that he had received the ineffective assistance of counsel because his attorneys had never prepared for the sentencing phase of trial. And second and third, he intended to raise claims that his waiver of his appellate rights had been coerced and was not freely and voluntarily made. In 2004, Judge Williams issued an order on Dennis's motion.
Since none of the grounds alleged by defendant in his proposed habeas petition require resorting to the transcript of the guilt-innocence phase of his trial, he is not entitled to said transcript at public expense, and his motion seeking that relief is denied.
Those transcripts would have cost thousands of dollars that Dennis Perry didn't have. His case proceeded without transcripts of anything but his sentencing agreement until 2005 and 2006, when he got the funding to obtain partial transcripts. Transcripts that we hope contain at least all the witness testimony in his case. But there's no closing arguments. Actually, there's no anything that happened on that last day of trial, before the verdict was returned. We do have the opening statements, though.
After opening statements, I wasn't feeling great for Dennis.
Oh, really?
I gotta tell you. No. Because after only opening statements, I mean, the defense did a really powerful job of hammering the fact that the evidence had been lost, but the prosecution laid out their story.
In its opening, the defense gave the jury a preview of all the evidence that was gone in this case. And it was a long list, an important list. But what it came down to was the prosecution telling a story of Dennis Perry's guilt and the defense saying, hey, wait, there was so much evidence of this guy's innocence, it's just that the Camden County Sheriff's Office lost it all. And many of the jurors still had strong memories of just how much evidence had been lost in this case.
However, there was a lot of lost, mishandled evidence as well. I remember that vividly. I think it was kind of a botched job from the beginning, possibly. You know, you kind of piece that together because of things that really should have been in place that didn't seem to be evidence-wise.
Donna Turner is kind of the wild card juror, and often her impressions and experiences at trial deviated from the norm set by other jurors we talked to. But in this respect, when it comes to the missing evidence, Donna Turner has the same view the rest of the jury had. And a lot of the other jurors we talked to told us the same thing about all the missing evidence, often with an eye roll. Because how on earth did the state manage to lose that much evidence? So that part of the defense's opening statement seems to have made an impression on the jury. But in contrast to the defense's litany of everything that had been lost in the case, the glasses, the Pepsi bottles, the mayor, the lineups, the alibi records, the arrays, the police notes, and on, what the state had in its opening was a solid story about why Dennis Perry was guilty. though it was not necessarily an accurate story. Take, for example, John Johnson's description of how Dennis Perry had made a literal confession to the murders.
Well, and those kind of statements in opening are why I left opening statements feeling quite troubled for Dennis, because they are very damning. They describe a confession that didn't happen and that no one testified happened.
None of the officers in this case, not even Dale Bundy, though he'd come the closest, would testify at trial that Dennis Perry had actually confessed in the way John Johnson described it as opening statement. But at least some of the jurors would come away from Dennis Perry's trial believing that Dennis Perry had admitted to this crime.
His big thing was he confessed, and there were numerous police witnesses to him confessing, and then he recanted, but he didn't say that. So, yeah.
Why would someone have confessed if they didn't do it?
Yeah, he said, like, you couldn't beat me with a stick long enough to have me confess to something I didn't do.
Care of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin supplement packs right to your door. Care of's fun online quiz asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices, and takes only 5 minutes to find out what vitamins and supplements you specifically need. Then, your vitamins get delivered right to your door in personalized, easy-to-remember daily packs that are perfect for a busy on-the-go lifestyle. And Care of puts honesty first, providing all the research that supports each of the recommendations backed by a scientific advisory board. Plus, a portion of every sale goes toward the Good Plus Foundation, which provides expectant mothers in need with valuable prenatal vitamins. And you can track your progress with the Care of app and earn rewards when you remember to take your vitamins. Finally, and this is a big one for me, Care of offers vegan and vegetarian supplement options to match your dietary needs. Now, I took the Care of quiz a couple of weeks ago, and I found it easy to complete and user-friendly. Recently, I've been looking for a good vegetarian omega-3 supplement, and Care of has the best option I've seen so far. They're Veggie Omega, which is sustainably sourced from a type of microalgae. And I got my delivery just before a trip, so Care of's daily packs made taking them so easy. And now you can try Care of too. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter the promo code undisclosed. That's takecareof.com, promo code undisclosed. On the first day of Dennis's trial, right after the opening statements were completed, the jury heard from Sheriff Bill Smith, as well as from the coroner who'd been at the crime scene. Nothing in their testimony directly implicated Dennis Perry, though Sheriff Smith made sure the jury knew how big and strong Harold Swain's pulpit or hands had been. On the second day, the jury heard from the church ladies. The first two, Vandora Baker and Letty Frazier, described what happened in the church that night, but they too said nothing to implicate Dennis Perry. Neither had been asked before to identify Dennis Perry, and neither were asked to do so at trial. And then, Vanzola Williams testified. She was the first witness to give evidence that pointed to Dennis Perry. Of all the women at the church that night, only Vanzola Williams had seen him up close when she spoke to him in the vestibule. Before trial, the defense had sought to exclude Vanzola Williams from identifying Jane Beaver's oval photo as the man she'd seen in the church that night due to how suggestive the single photo identification procedure had been. Judge Williams had denied the motion, writing,
"While these events may have been somewhat suggestive, Ms. Williams did not positively identify defendant as a perpetrator of the murders when the officer showed her his photograph."
The identification procedure couldn't have been that suggestive, Judge Williams ruled, because it hadn't worked. Vanzola Williams hadn't been able to positively identify Dennis Perry. And at the pretrial hearing, this was true. Again and again, Vanzola Williams says she isn't sure if Dennis Perry was the man she'd seen in the vestibule. "Not sure, I wasn't sure, I can't be sure," she says. She says this over a dozen times. But then, at Dennis Perry's trial, when the jury is listening, when it actually matters, Vanzola Williams changes her story. "Dennis Perry looks like the killer," she says. On cross-examination, the defense works hard to pin Vanzola Williams into a corner. And finally, she admits that previously, she'd testified she hadn't been sure. But the damage is done. Vanzola Williams sounds as if she's confident that Dennis Perry is the killer, when before she'd been full of doubts. Later, the defense will have GBI agent Joe Gregory testify that back in 1988, when Dennis Perry's name was the first one called in by a tipster, he'd gotten a photo of him from the DMV, put it in a 6-photo array, and shown it to Vanzola Williams.
And Vanzola looked at that. She could not pick out anybody. Nobody even was close, according to her.
Thank you.
From a defense perspective, Dennis Perry's trial was a trial of lost opportunities. Again and again, they had opportunities where it seems like, just by digging in a little, they could have scored easy but potentially significant points in undermining the state's case. And again, they turned those opportunities away. Take, for example, the testimony of the medical examiner, Dr. Larry Howard, who performed the autopsies on Harold and Thelma Swain. He also testified on day two, and when he took the stand, the defense attorney Dale Westling told the court,
"Judge, we're willing to stipulate to this gentleman's credentials to give expert testimony as to the cause of death and any other forensics he may have discovered in doing the autopsies in these bodies."
But perhaps the defense shouldn't have been so hasty in stipulating to all the medical examiner's findings. To begin with, Dr. Howard's report is full of inconsistent and confusing claims, with important details about the autopsies completely omitted from his report. And for another, it's not at all clear whether he had the expertise to be giving the sorts of opinions he was giving about the gunshot residue.
Recently, Jennifer was looking up Dr. Howard to see if there was any chance he was still around so that we could speak to him. He's not, but while searching, Jennifer found an old news article about him.
Oh no.
What?
Uh-oh.
"I respect Dr. Howard and Dr. Dawson," said Burton, "but I do not think they are qualified. In the past few months, I've learned things that shape that opinion. Larry Howard and Brian Dawson specialize in shootings and stabbings," Burton points out. "Anyone can look at a body and see it has been shot. Most anyone can trace the course of that bullet. You could do it, but that's only a small portion of what a pathologist is supposed to do."
Dr. Larry Howard, it turns out, does not have the background you might have expected.
They call him Dr. Howard.
So you assume it's a medical doctor.
But it's a PhD. It's not a medical doctor.
Which means an actual pathologist has never reviewed the autopsy results in this case. It was never actually established whether Dr. Howard, PhD in pharmacology, was actually qualified to opine on the autopsy results, or on the meaning of the gunpowder residue that was found at the scene. And given some of his testimony, it's reasonable to have questions about his work. For instance, Dr. Howard testified that he couldn't say if gunpowder particles had been found in the gunshot wound to Harold Swain's head, because Harold Swain had black hair, and gunpowder particles are also black. And he only had a flashlight, so how could he tell?
On that same day of trial, there was actually testimony from a medical doctor. But that testimony was not about anything related to forensics. It was Cora Fisher's doctor, and he was there to testify as to why Cora Fisher could not come to court to testify.
And the prosecutor asks, "Tell us, if you would please, why Cora, what the medical reasons are that will prevent her from coming to this court to testify." And he says, "Well, there are two parts to that." And then the prosecutor asks, "Let's talk about her physical condition."
Oh, interesting.
With part one's the physical condition, that would seem to imply that part two is the mental condition. And no one asked him about it. What if she really was mentally incompetent?
Another lost opportunity. The defense attorneys declined to ask Cora Fisher's doctor any questions of their own, and we'll never know what the second reason was. And Cora Fisher did not testify in person, so the jury had no ability to evaluate her mental condition for themselves.
When I talked to Dale Bundy, I was hoping he could give me some more insight on Cora Fisher's mental condition. He'd spoken to her on at least three different occasions, which was more than anyone else in the case had. So I asked him, was there anything that ever caused him to question Cora Fisher's mental competence?
Yeah, at the trial, they had to go to a nursing home and interview her.
Did she seem like mentally?
She was just fine.
I don't know.
As a matter of fact, the defense attorney showed her a picture of a Florida driver's license that they had copied with Donnie Barentine's picture on it. And he asked her, he says, "Miss Cora, do you recognize the person in this picture?" She says, "How am I going to recognize that?" He says, "You can't recognize it either. It's a terrible copy." And she gave it back to him. Yeah, Miss Cora was still Miss Cora. Yeah, her mind was still okay at the time.
And yeah.
They went and tried to depose her, and, you know, she...
She held up?
Oh, yeah. She did just fine.
What Bundy said here was a big deal. I just didn't realize it at all. I think I'd assume that he'd been talking about some sort of interview with Cora Fisher that hadn't been recorded, because I'd never seen anything in the case file that matched what he was describing. But it turns out what he's talking about is actually what happened at Cora Fisher's deposition, the one read into the record at Dennis Perry's trial. It's just that Bundy's description of what happened is so far off from what really happened that it's unrecognizable. Although in this case, the transcripts themselves are also misleading. As Jennifer Whitfield pointed out, what had really happened at Cora Fisher's deposition is the exact opposite of what Bundy claims.
Yeah. She identified Donnie Barentine at trial as the shooter.
No, she didn't.
Oh, she did.
No, she wasn't at trial.
Yes. In her deposition.
She wasn't at trial. She never saw him.
No, in her deposition, the defense shows her a picture of Donnie Barentine and says, is this the shooter? And she says, yes. They absolutely do.
Jennifer was right. They absolutely do. At Cora Fisher's deposition, the defense shows her a photo of a man and asks her if the man in the photo is the man she saw in the church the night the Swains were killed. Cora Fisher says, yes, it is. Only, in the transcript, no one actually identifies the photo that Cora Fisher is being shown at the time. And if you're only reading the transcript and don't have access to any of the exhibits, like we don't, it's easy to assume that the photo in question must be a photo of Dennis Perry. That's what I thought. But it's not. It's a photo of Donnie Barentine.
And then she's asked, are you pretty sure that that boy at the top picture, who's Donnie Barentine, she's not told that, but that the boy at the top picture is the boy you saw in the church that night? She says, yes. Which is a plain identification of Donnie Barentine as the shooter in the church that night.
The state's star eyewitness identified the defense's alternate suspect as the killer, and for some reason, there's not a single word about it in the defense's opening statement. We have to assume they did at least bring it up in closing, but from the transcripts we have, this whole identification of Donnie Barentine is only ever brought up once during the evidentiary portion of the case, and that was during the cross-examination of Dale Bundy. Defense attorney Dale Westling asked Bundy about it directly. Were you there when Cora Fisher identified the photo of Donnie Barentine as the killer? And he says, yes, I was there.
And the defense asks, well, did that cause you a little worry? Answer, no, sir. Just no concern. He did not, right. Not bothered by it at all.
Yeah, you do hear from the transcript, too, that the defense attorney on at least, I think, two occasions asks the judge to direct Dale Bundy to stop smirking at the jury. And it gives that kind of answer a little color, right? If you can imagine him sort of smiling at the jury in this like knowing way. He's approaching it from an overabundance of confidence.
I have been taking better care of myself in the past year than I have for a long time. That means I'm eating better, I am working out, I am taking my vitamins, and I'm actually sleeping better, which is such an important part of taking care of yourself. And honestly, without it, everything else falls apart. Look, we're never gonna agree on everything, people don't, but I think we can agree that all of us could use more sleep and better sleep. And now getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need an expensive new mattress, you don't need sleeping pills, you just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Every single thing that Boll & Branch makes, from their bedding to their blankets, it's made from 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. I love my Boll & Branch sheets, and you know what? My kids love it, my cats love it. It's really hard to get my bed to myself. And you can buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices, and you're getting these luxury sheets that cost like literally up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of $100. Everybody who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. They have thousands of five-star reviews. Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, everybody's talking about Boll & Branch. And yes, three U.S. presidents sleep on these sheets. Now look, the shipping is free. You can try them out for 30 nights. And if you don't love them, you send them back for a refund. Not only that, get them for yourself. Honestly, get them for yourself. But they make a great gift. I have gifted them. They come beautifully packaged. And who doesn't love gorgeous, soft bedding? Whoever you give it to, I mean, every time they fall into those sheets, they're going to love you. So to get you started right now, our listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com if you use the promo code undisclosed. Go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's boll, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, BowlandBranch.com, promo code undisclosed. Once again, that's BowlandBranch.com. Once again, that's BowlandBranch.com, and use the promo code undisclosed. On day three of Dennis Perry's trial, the jury heard from Butch Kennedy, from Carol Ann Rayborn, and from Jane Beaver. Butch Kennedy described his work during the initial investigation, while Carol Ann told the prosecutor she'd never said that Dennis Perry had called her on March 10, 1985, to tell her he was in Waverly. The prosecutor then put GBI agent Ron Rhodes on the stand, who testified that he interviewed Carol Ann in 1998, and she had said Dennis called her on exactly March 10, 1985. Though, Agent Rhodes said he never thought to ask her how she possibly could have known the date of a phone call that happened 13 years ago. And then Jane Beaver testified. She came off as a credible witness, and her testimony was damning. It also came with an unexpected surprise, one that Dennis's defense attorneys had been given no warning about in advance of trial. Here's a transcript from Prosecutor John Johnson's direct examination of Jane Beaver.
Is there another way to get there from Mr. Wilson's house to the area around the church?
There's a fire break through the woods.
And if you go that way, how far is it?
Probably 5 minutes.
Camden County is mostly timberland. That timberland is crisscrossed with fire breaks, clear-cut strips in the woods that, in the event of a forest fire, are intended to slow a fire's advance. And at first, it's not clear why John Johnson wants to talk to Jane Beaver about fire breaks, because he moves on with his questioning. But then, a few minutes later, he circles back. Now, about those fire breaks. What does Dennis Perry know about them? John Johnson asks Jane Beaver. The defense objects. They are confused about why Jane Beaver is being asked about fire breaks of all things, but the question is inappropriate regardless, and anyway, any testimony about conversations involving the defendant should have been disclosed in advance of trial. This certainly never was. But John Johnson tells Judge Williams that he himself only learned about these fire breaks 5 minutes ago during a brief recess when Jane Beaver told him about it for the very first time. So Judge Williams rules that since the prosecutor had only just learned of it himself, she was going to allow the evidence to come in.
That's why at Dennis Perry's trial, Jane Beaver ends up spending a lot of her testimony talking about fire breaks and how she'd once been in Waverly visiting Carol Ann when Dennis Perry came to visit. She'd asked Dennis how he got into Carol Ann's place, and he told her, "I walked the fire break." Jane Beaver tells the court she only knows about one fire break that Dennis Perry walked on, and that's the one between his grandparents' house and Carol Ann's house. But she says if Dennis Perry knew about this fire break, he might know about other fire breaks, such as fire breaks that ran through the timberland behind Rising Daughter and back over toward the roads connecting up with the road Dennis Perry lived on.
And this is why, when Jennifer and I were down Waverly one day, we went out searching for fire breaks. As we were driving around, I was telling Jennifer about how, after all this fire break stuff came up at trial, there'd been a brief period when the attorneys in the court were considering taking the jury out to Waverly to see the supposed fire breaks for themselves. Eventually, though, defense attorney Dale Westling had made a call. "I'm not going out there," he said. "I'm afraid of snakes." And Judge Williams replied, "So am I." So that was that. No field trip to the fire breaks. And I was telling Jennifer all this, but really what I was doing was trying to convince her that, yes, we actually need to be out here driving around looking for fire breaks for ourselves.
Why didn't they go to the site and just, then the jurors can see that it's all a bunch of confusing nonsense.
But more importantly, who cares?
Okay, that's a good point.
I don't understand. I mean, instead, I think, why was it made an issue at all? I don't...
Because they have to explain how, he didn't have a car. They have to explain how he got there.
From his house to the church.
The thing is, though, there were people who cared about these fire breaks. They cared about the fire breaks a lot. And these people were on Dennis Perry's jury. That's why this matters. Multiple jurors from Dennis Perry's trial have described this fire break thing as a big reason for why they convicted Dennis Perry. It wasn't just the juror that Ed and Claire talked to, the one who had three reasons for why Dennis Perry was guilty, and number two was the fire breaks. Even jurors who'd initially had some doubts about Dennis Perry's guilt, who had been more sympathetic to his case, had found this evidence to be convincing. As one of the jurors told us, "I remember that for a little while I had doubts that he'd done it, but then I wasn't so sure. They came up with, there was this trail, a path from the church to where he lived, and he'd gotten to borrow money from the pastor before, and the pastor wouldn't loan him the money." Some of the jurors didn't recall the fire breaks at all, but a lot of them did. And all the jurors who recalled the fire breaks, except for one, found them to be very compelling evidence. The exception, of course, is the wild card, Donna Turner.
And they kept making a reference to this logging trail several times. How you could cut through the woods, go through this logging trail, and come up to the church. And I, you know, what is the relevance in talking about a logging trail to the church? Every once in a while, it would just get really screwy, like, why are we here?
Donna seems to have been the only one in the jury to have that opinion, though. So off to the fire breaks Jennifer and Susan went.
Jennifer and I started off by checking out what I'm going to call fire break number one. That's the fire break that Jane Beaver actually testified about that she'd actually seen Dennis Perry use. It runs between Dover Bluff and US 17 and roughly connects up Dennis Perry's grandparents' house with Carol Ann's house.
We are in the fire break. So it's basically just a really beaten down dirt road, a bunch of houses on it. And there's the lake.
And it doesn't quite make it to Jane Beaver's trailer.
Well, right? You could walk around the lake, I guess. I mean, I could see someone possibly making a cut through here. I don't know. But this is not a... Like, she makes it sound like it's a secret fire break, not like a road. I mean, it's a crappy road, but...
It's not clear to me that this is what it was, though, 30 years ago.
Nothing is, but also it wouldn't have been... There were houses here, though, so it was like this.
I guess you could call the thing we were driving down a fire break, but it's also a road that people live on. So, really, I'd just call it a road. And, at least today, it's even got a stop sign and a little green street sign. William's Place, it said. It's a road. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, our trip to this first fire break slash road had not left Jennifer any more impressed with this whole fire break theory.
I still am struggling with why him using a cut through to get from his house to her daughter's trailer somehow implicates him in a murder.
Because it proves he can move like a ninja with no one noticing him. I don't know.
Which is insane. It can proves that he walks from one place to another. I don't understand it.
It's because, I mean, after all the work they did to prove he, like, used a motorcycle to get down here, that he could have owned a duster, and then they just go, oh, he walked.
After checking out fire break number one, it was time to go check out fire break number two. This is the fire break that actually mattered for purposes of the murder trial, because it's the fire break that Dennis Perry potentially could have used to walk back from Rising Daughter to his grandparents' house after the murder. But checking out fire break number two was going to be a harder task for a few reasons. First, this fire break isn't an actual thing. Not like fire break number one is a thing. Fire break number two is just a hypothetical concept. All we know is that at Dennis Perry's trial, Jane Beaver testified that there were fire breaks back in the timberland that went between Spring Bluff Road and US 17, and which someone could have used to walk from Rising Daughter back to Dennis' grandparents' house. Problem is, there's no actual fire break that's ever been identified as a fire break in question. In fact, Jane Beaver had personally never seen or heard of Dennis Perry using any fire breaks back there. She just thought it was possible that he could have used them, assuming they existed. Anyway, Jane Beaver wouldn't have known for herself if they did or not, because she certainly never walked down them. And the second reason that fire break number two would be harder for us to check out is that it was going to be much, much longer than fire break number one was. William's Place, the fire break slash road that cuts across from the Wilson's Place to Carol Ann's Place, is only 0.2 mile long. But this second fire break, the hypothetical one, would run somewhere between Spring Bluff and Rising Daughter, which means it'd have to be anywhere between 1 and 2.5 miles long as the crow flies. In the end, Jennifer and I just decided to take the first dirt road we came to in Spring Bluff and see what happened.
Oh God, is this a terrible idea?
Not yet.
No, it's not.
Oh, look at this. This is a real road.
This is a road.
Well, I don't. Maybe not real, but it is a road.
Now, satellite images show that this particular road that we were on did not actually exist before 2000. Still, even though Dennis Perry could never have traveled along this roadway back in 1985, any pathways that had existed back then probably would have looked something like this one. So we drove along it as far as we could in a direction that we hoped was more or less towards Rising Daughter.
Drive it like a rental.
But I don't want to get stuck. I don't want to...
Oh my gosh.
The road stopped being any kind of road, so we got out and started walking. It wasn't too bad of a hike. The land back there, at least now in 2018, is a broad, flat expanse of swamps and mostly clear timberland. And if you're careful, you can pick your way through it.
End of the world pretty? Yeah. It is.
Isn't it? Like, I feel like there's been, like, we are currently looking at what it would appear to be if there had been a nuclear disaster.
We're like 5 or 6 years post-nuclear disaster.
Right.
It is pretty back there, but it's also pretty desolate.
Is that vulture here for us?
Yes.
Then again, all of this is just based on what the land looks like now in 2018. The pine trees that once grew here could have been harvested and regrown twice over in the time since the Swains were killed. There is no saying what exactly it looked like on March 11th, 1985. Still, if you had to get from Rising Daughter to Spring Bluff through that timberland, could you do it? Yeah, I think you could. There's just no reason you would. Not under normal conditions. Because it's not a shortcut. It's a massive long cut, or whatever the opposite of a shortcut is. If you're walking along the roadway, then the trip from Rising Daughter Baptist Church to the Wilson's house where Dennis was living is an easy stroll of about 0.9 miles. But by taking the fire break that most likely would have been available back in 1985, that stroll becomes a 2.8-mile slog.
If the theory, 30 years ago, it was like it is today, and the theory is that he went there through the fire break, wouldn't he be notably...
Dirty? Likely.
Swampy?
I think the theory would have to be that he walked in the road like a normal person, and after it turned into a murder by accident or whatever happened, that's when he would try and escape unseen, which is would allow you to do.
Probably would allow you to do anyway. We didn't actually walk it the whole way ourselves. Too many swamps. Instead, we went back to the car and drove back around US 17 to see what the fire break might have looked like from the other side. Not far down from Rising Daughter, there's a dirt road coming off from the highway that heads back towards the clear timberland where we'd just been. So we started walking down it, trying to get our bearings.
So, with the caveat that one clump of trees looks like another, I think we were on the other side of those trees.
Yeah.
It's a really good thing that Jennifer and I weren't trying to recreate the entire firebreak journey that day. Because later, when I compared where we'd been against satellite images of the whole area, I realized that the clump of trees we'd been looking at was definitely not the right clump of trees. If we'd tried to walk towards there, we'd have ended up bushwhacking our way through about 2 miles of swamp and brush before we got back to a real road. Here's what it all comes down to. As a matter of everyday transportation, it is wildly implausible to think that Dennis Perry would have ever walked down the fire breaks to get to Rising Daughter, or to get anywhere else. There's just no reason whatsoever for him to do so. Walking the roadway is much quicker and much easier. Also, while it would be completely possible for someone who was not familiar with the land back there to find a way to walk from one side to the other, remember, the theory here isn't that Dennis Perry was making this journey in the daytime. He was doing it at 9 o'clock at night.
When I was stayed in Camden County after he left, I went back at night to try.
Yeah.
I didn't get very far.
It's an insane thing to do at night.
I was already poor. I had my phone on this flashlight. So already I'm cheating. And like I get out there and the branches started hitting my legs. And I was like, no, I don't have to do this. I'm not going to do it.
And in the middle of broad daylight, I was like, I don't know. I feel like, there could be critters and things.
No, I like hiking. And hiking in the dark is not something I have a problem with. But hiking through swampy land on a poorly defined path? Given that I couldn't actually prove that the conditions there now were the same as the conditions faced by someone fleeing Rising Daughter back in 85, and given that none of this actually meant anything, I decided to take a pass in the experiment. But even assuming the land back there now is similar to how it was back then, could someone have crossed from US 17 to Spring Bluff at night without a flashlight and with no familiarity with the path? I don't know, but I'm very skeptical that anyone would have tried. It'd be a crazy decision to make, even in the heat of a frantic moment. Besides, there is no evidence whatsoever that that's what actually happened here. Jane Beaver was just speculating. She had no idea what paths were back there, and she had no idea if Dennis Perry knew what paths were back there. She was just guessing. But at trial, when this whole theory was suddenly sprung on the defense out of nowhere, the defense was caught off guard. They'd never heard about these fire breaks, and in the moment, they'd had no way to counteract Jane Beaver's speculation with actual facts.
But bottom line, if they had disclosed that this was their theory of the case...
Yes.
Then the defense would have been prepared to put on information about the duster. You know, the reason why...
But is that going to help you? Like, haha, he's not guilty because he didn't walk here. He's guilty because he drove a car there.
But there's no indication that he had a duster.
Well, how's that help them? So there's one witness who's bullshit, but is that really...
No, I mean, it shows that they don't have any idea how he could have done this crime.
They don't. That is true.
I was being too cynical and defeatist here. Jennifer was right. If the defense had known about the fire breaks, if they'd known that was the theory in advance, they could have not only investigated how unlikely that claim really was, but they also could have been prepared to introduce at trial all the evidence that the killer had driven a car to Rising Daughter. Something that, going into trial, the defense must have been assuming the state would plan on introducing. That evidence largely never did come in, not directly. Only one of the jurors we spoke to even picked up on it. Instead, most of the jurors believed Dennis Perry had walked to Rising Daughter, and so they believed he was guilty.
As you know, the holidays are the busiest time of the year, especially at the post office. That's why I use Stamps.com. It saves me so much time during the hectic holiday season. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Post Office right to your desktop. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Then, the mail carrier picks it up. No trips to the post office required. It couldn't be easier. You can print postage any day, anytime. Stamps.com is always open. And Stamps.com not only saves you time, it saves you money. Stamps.com helps you print the right amount of postage every time so you never overpay again. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts on postage you can't even get at the post office. With all the time and money you'll save, Stamps.com is the best gift you can give yourself this holiday season. Now, in addition to my day job and working undisclosed, I'm working on three separate briefs to the Supreme Court. And that's involved me getting and sending documents to three different states. And as has been the case for the past several years, Stamps.com has saved me so much time and stress in the process that I've somehow been able to make everything work out. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed.
When I mentioned to Butch Kennedy that I'd spoken to some of the jurors, he'd asked me about why they'd made the decision they'd made. What had made them convict Dennis Perry?
And like one guy told me that the fire breaks proved he was guilty, when I'm not even sure there were fire breaks.
It was so grown up in that area back there that I don't know that you could get from the, I'm sure you can. I think Dale went down that fire break.
So there was a fire break.
There was where a fire break had been.
Butch Kennedy had no idea that the fire breaks had actually been a part of the state's case at trial. This was news to him. But he had heard about the fire breaks before. Dale Bundy had told him about them.
The first time anyone ever heard of it was Jane Beaver at trial when she comes up with this fire break thing.
I remember Dale saying something to me about it.
Before or after the trial, do you think?
Before.
You mentioned fire breaks being a thing.
It's perfect. He said it's perfect. He could have just done that and walked right straight down the fire break, right out into his grandfather's house.
If Butch Kennedy is right, Dale Bundy had known about the fire breaks long before Dennis Perry ever went to trial. It was Bundy's own personal theory about how this murder had been committed. Which means, given everything else that's gone on in this case, I have to wonder. Did this whole story about fire breaks really come from Jane Beaver, who spontaneously recalled it in the middle of trial? Or did this story really come from Dale Bundy?
Dale told me about them. He said that was an escape route. And I'm thinking it's the same time that he showed me the picture of Dennis and the baby on the floor.
A couple of days after our field trip down the fire breaks, Jennifer sent me an email. She'd done some more research into the timberland that we'd been walking around on back there, in the section between Spring Bluff and Rising Daughter, and she'd pulled up the deed info to find out who owned it. Maybe we could interview the owner and find out more about the fire breaks. Maybe even get copies of maps of what it was like back then. It turned out, though, that another interview would not be necessary. I had already interviewed the owner, because at the time of Dennis Perry's arrest and trial, that land had been owned by Dale Bundy.
On day 4 of Dennis Perry's trial, the three officers present at Dennis Perry's post-arrest interrogation all testify. They describe statements that Dennis Perry had made, and the officers told the jury that these statements were a confession. And this when the jurors who so far had harbored doubts about Dennis Perry's guilt began to feel those doubts slip away.
As bad as I felt for him when the comment was made, and he didn't say this, and I'm thinking it was the guy from JSO, and I could be wrong. Could have even been the attorney. I'm not sure, but somebody made the comment that I was so high that night, I really can't remember a whole lot. And I was like, God, you know.
It wasn't just the confession by itself that damned Dennis Perry. It's how it fit in with the rest of the state's case. Because if I had to choose a single most important reason that Dennis Perry was convicted, it wouldn't be Jane Beaver or the eyewitness identifications or the composite image. If I had to choose just one reason, it would be the fact that throughout the trial, prosecutor John Johnson's witnesses falsely portrayed Dennis Perry as a drug addict.
Oh my goodness. So I now feel badly about my initial reaction, but after I read through the transcript the first time, I had in my mind a picture of a pretty severely addicted drug addict, you know, somebody who was suffering from pretty significant substance abuse.
Jennifer Whitfield reached the exact same conclusion the jurors had after sitting through Dennis Perry's trial.
You told me it was heroin was like in there, and you're like, oh, it looked, I read it in transcript. I'm like, I don't remember that. So I was searching them all. I'm like, where does it say heroin? How'd I miss that?
I was confident. In my mind, yeah, I was. That's what I pictured after reading the transcript the first time, and I also could not find heroin in the transcript when I went back to look. So,
the word heroin is nowhere in the transcripts. All that's mentioned is Dennis Perry using drugs, being on drugs, being high.
The way they talk about it, it doesn't sound like the dude who, you know, once in a while smokes a blunt.
No, I mean, there's references to him having this, you know, drug disorder or drug addiction or drug problem. I mean, it's just referenced over and over and over.
Most of these references were made by Jane Beaver. The rest came from Dale Bundy. It's all just hearsay, and it's not true. But the jury, just like Jennifer, thought that it was an uncontested fact that Dennis Perry was a junkie.
What do you think the motive was for this crime?
Drugs. No doubt in my mind.
On this point, Donna Turner was on the same page as the rest of the jury, the same wrong page. And this incorrect belief provided the jury with a way to answer all the questions that had been left unanswered by the state's case. It was all right if the state's case didn't make complete sense. It didn't have to, because drug addicts often don't make sense either. On day 4 of Dennis Perry's trial, the state rests its case. At 3:45 p.m. that afternoon, the defense begins to put on its case, and over the next 3 hours, they will call 11 witnesses, though many of those witnesses were only on the stand for a couple of minutes.
You know, we know from the testimony at the habeas hearing that was challenging the voluntariness of Dennis's waiver of his appeal rights that the defense was predicated on two main theories. One is to shift the blame to Donnie Barentine and to explain to the jury how Donnie Barentine committed this crime. And the other was to explain that Dennis Perry had an alibi at the time of the crime. And the witnesses they put up as part of their defense were intended to, you know, further those defense theories.
The defense's strategy was clear. It just didn't work. In our recaps of juror interviews, the same theme kept coming up over and over again.
But it sounded like he felt like the defense was just distraction and was bullshit and convicted almost based on that because there was essentially no defense, he believed.
Dennis Perry's alibi hadn't seemed credible, and neither had the defense's efforts to point the finger at another suspect. And that flailing, desperate attempt at a defense had just made Dennis Perry look that much more guilty. Dennis Perry did have an alibi, though. The last witness the defense calls at trial is GBI agent Joe Gregory, and he testifies that back in 1988, when Dennis had been called in as a suspect, he had investigated and vetted Dennis Perry's alibi. The notes from his case file would confirm it, he tells a jury. On the day the Swains were killed, Dennis Perry had been on the job in Atlanta, working for a concrete company there, and he could not have made it to Waverly in time to commit the crime. The problem was, Agent Gregory no longer had the notes from his case file. Those had gone missing. But at trial, the defense doesn't just rely on Joe Gregory in making its case for Dennis's alibi. They also call an old family friend to the stand. This is the same friend who had gotten Dennis the job at the concrete factory in the first place. And he tells the jury that he drove Dennis to and from work every day since Dennis didn't have a car, and that on the week of the murders, Dennis Perry hadn't missed a day of work.
When I talked to Joe Gregory and told him I'd spoken to some of the jurors from Dennis's trial, Dennis's alibi was the first thing he wanted to know about.
Did you ask them why they did not believe the witnesses that put Perry in Atlanta?
I did.
Did they say?
You know, it was so frustrating. They're just like, oh, we know how it goes. You know, you want to be nice and do like a favor for a friend, but how could you possibly remember that day that long ago?
The jury had assumed that this family friend who had driven Dennis Perry to and from work was just trying to help a friend out, and that he couldn't actually recall this week in question all those years ago.
It was all verified, but I thought everybody, probably the same as Perry's attorney, that they would believe the guy.
The jury hadn't believed the guy. And without the missing GBI case file, Dennis Perry had no way to show the jury that his alibi had in fact been documented 15 years before.
The alibi was the less important prong of Dennis Perry's defense, though. The cornerstone of his defense was Donnie Barentine. Everything was about Donnie Barentine. And he was there, in person, hauled in from Florida to testify at Dennis's trial, so the defense could point at him and say, "This man is the real killer. He's the one you want, not Dennis Perry." It's not very often that the defense in a murder case actually puts an alternate suspect on the stand and has him testify. And in any case, when this does happen, it'll probably be among the most dramatic moments of the entire trial. At the very least, it should not be a forgettable part of the case. That's not what happened in Dennis Perry's case.
None of them had much at all to say about what the defense put on. Did you notice that? None of them seemed to have a very good grasp of what the defense had been at all.
Right, which is insane because it was obviously like an alternate suspect.
Many, probably most of the jurors, did not recall Donnie Barentine and did not recall there had even been an alternate suspect. The jurors who did remember Barentine found the whole thing ludicrous. "We weighed the alternate suspects," one of the jurors said, "and it all goes back to the fact that nothing was stolen, nothing taken. It makes no sense somebody from out of town would just be driving by and decide to shoot this couple in the church." But reading through the transcripts, it kind of makes sense why Donnie Barentine's testimony didn't make much of an impact. It's dull stuff. The defense asks him if he's killed the Swains, and Barentine says no. Then they ask him if he ever confessed to killing the Swains, and Barentine says he doesn't remember. Over and over. "Did you confess at a party?" "Not that I remember." "Did you confess to cutting the phone wires?" "Not that I remember." It may not have been what the defense expected, but Donnie Barentine's testimony would have not been a surprise to the prosecution. In April of 2002, prosecutor John Johnson sent an email to Donnie Barentine. He gave Barentine a brief update on the status of the Swain investigation and warns Barentine that the defense investigators may be looking for him.
John Johnson tells Barentine he won't give the defense Barentine's home address for a little while yet, but eventually they'll probably find him and try to talk to him. And in that email, John Johnson tells Barentine what he should tell the defense investigators if and when they do find him. John Johnson writes,
"As I told you, if you said the things that all those people say you said, that's okay. If you don't remember, that's okay too. If you deny it, then they can bring in all those people to say you said these things and make it look like you did. You have told us that you don't remember and could have said it. That's fine with me."
Even if Donnie Barentine's trial testimony was forgettable, Donnie Barentine himself wasn't. Donna Turner is one of the jurors who recalls Donnie Barentine, and to this day, her memory of him is vivid.
I mean, he walked in with the swagger, "I'm Billy Badass."
But Donna Turner, like all the other jurors who even recalled Donnie Barentine playing a role in the case, had not been impressed with the defense's evidence about him. There was a string of witnesses the defense called, one after the other, to testify about this party they'd been to back in 1985 down in Mariana, Florida. Jeff Cottrell is the most important one. He is the one who was arrested with Donnie Barentine in Telfair County in 1985, and the first one to tell the police that Barentine and his blonde friend had killed the Swains. Sue Wilkes testified too. She'd been Jeff Cottrell's girlfriend in 1985, and she told the police she'd heard Donnie Barentine bragging at a party that he killed a black couple at a church.
Then they bring another one in. She was also coming out of jail. You know, in my mind, I had to push that just out. Like,
what is this nonsense? Yeah.
What is this? Yeah. Because to me, the credibility, it just wasn't there.
Just like D.A. Glenn Thomas had predicted long ago, when he'd refused to charge Donnie Barentine back in 1985, the jurors found these witnesses underwhelming.
Jeff Cottrell passed away a few years ago, but I talked to Sue Wilkes earlier this year, and she still stands by her story. I can see, though, how a jury might have been wary of putting too much weight in her testimony, because I'm wary of putting too much weight on her testimony. She can be somewhat scattered, but more importantly, when it gets down to it, she just doesn't know much about this case. She never has. All she's ever known is that 33 years ago, she heard Donnie Barentine bragging about something he'd done in Georgia.
They were laughing about that?
Yeah, when they was coming back, yeah. When they come back, that was what was told. That they walked into church, and when they went in to shoot the people, was it black people? The niggers, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, when they come in and shot, that's how it was put out there like that.
That's how they were saying it.
Yeah, not, but I would say it like that. But that, it varied, that, when they walked in, the niggers jumped up and started hollering, and they turned around and shot them.
Sue Wilkes doesn't really recall many details beyond that, assuming that she ever really knew more details beyond that in the first place.
Because it sounds like Donnie claimed to have done a lot of crimes.
He did. He did a bunch of stuff.
But that's what I'm trying to figure out. Was he just talking, or did he mean it?
He mean it. I've seen him. He mean it. Donnie was crazy.
You don't think he could have been bragging?
No. No.
Like just making stuff up, like, "Oh, I'm so bad, I'm so tough, I did all this." Mm-hmm. You thought he was 100% real.
Yeah, I knew he was real.
Though, Sue Wilkes did say one thing to me that she definitely didn't say at Dennis Perry's trial. And that was about Jeff Cottrell, who would also be called as defense witness to point the finger at Donnie Barentine.
Do you think Jeff did it too?
I think Jeff was stand back guy that had a hand in it, but I don't think that. I think Donnie was the mastermind of it.
But you think Jeff might have been there? So, because Jeff, the way Jeff tells it is that he only heard from Donnie what happened, that he wasn't there himself. But you think Jeff might have actually been there?
Mm-hmm.
You're nodding, yeah.
There was one potential witness for the defense who, notably to the jury, did not testify at Dennis Perry's trial. And that was Dennis Perry himself. With Donna Turner, I got the impression that throughout the whole trial, she'd been wanting to believe in Dennis Perry's innocence. That in some way, she'd been silently rooting for him, hoping he'd find a way to pull through and show that no, he hadn't done this. Something to refute the things the state was saying about him.
I just hate it was so detrimental what we were told that he said, but he never said it himself to us verbally. I was so high. I don't remember a lot of that night, but I just feel like he should have got up on that stage, he should have fought for his life. Tell me something, give me something, throw me a bone, you know, just throw me a bone. And we got no bones.
I don't think she wanted to believe the state's case, But Dennis Perry, in his defense, hadn't given her anything else to believe either.
Could have been the attorney. I'm not sure, but somebody made the comment that I was so high that night, I really can't remember a whole lot. And I was like, God, you know, I mean, can't you remember anything? I really feel if he had had a chance to speak his piece and give an account of that night, it probably could have went a different way.
Donna wasn't the only one who felt this way, though. While talking to other jurors, I'd asked them what had convinced them of Dennis Perry's guilt, and several of them had mentioned the fact that he'd never testified. They all knew on some level that this was wrong. They knew this wasn't something they could actually say during deliberations, and they all stressed that no one actually said it. But inside, unsaid, it's what they felt. One juror told us, when the murderer didn't take the stand, well, that stood out. That's a chance you take. He should have taken it. The jurors are wrong. Wrong constitutionally in giving any consideration to whether or not Dennis Perry testified. But they're also just wrong practically in believing that Dennis Perry should have taken that chance and testified in his own defense. Because what the jury wanted here, and what the jury never got, was some kind of an answer to the state's case. And that's something Dennis Perry could never have given them.
What if he'd gotten up there and said, it was 18 years ago and I have no idea where I was on a random night 18 years ago?
Then personally, I think, something this traumatic and you're being held accountable for it and you've already been questioned one time about it?
In its case against Dennis Perry, the state called 15 witnesses over the course of 3 days. The defense was briefer, calling 11 witnesses over the course of 3 hours. At the close of the defense's case, it was clear to many of the observers in the courtroom which way the winds were blowing. There were a few reporters Susan had spoken to who were present for the whole trial, and all of them thought the same thing.
Your sense that everyone thought he'd get acquitted?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were joking about it in the hallway. Like, you know, come on, quit wasting our time. You know, we just felt sure he was going to be acquitted.
The prosecution must have shared the reporters' feelings to some degree, because the plea offer they made to Dennis Perry in the middle of his trial suggests that they distinctly lacked confidence in their own case. Before trial, Dennis Perry had already turned down a number of proposed plea deals from the state. But this time at trial, the prosecution must have thought he was making an offer that Dennis Perry couldn't refuse. Time served. Dennis Perry had already been in jail for 37 months at that point, while awaiting trial. The state told him, plead guilty to a lesser offense and you'll walk out today. Dennis Perry said no. At 4 p.m. that Friday, the fifth day of Dennis Perry's trial, the jury began its deliberations. By 7:30 p.m., they had a verdict.
We weren't unanimous in the beginning. We were not. But in the end, he was convicted. And I wanted to slump out of that place and hide. I mean, his family, you know, all of them were out there, you know, with banners. I mean, it was just so sure that he was going to get to go home. And he didn't. So.
Thanks for listening to Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry. We'll be back on Thursday with an addendum episode, so send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo is designed by Paluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crime Writers On podcast. You can find case-related materials, timelines of key events, and witness charts on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. Transcripts of this episode and past episodes are available on our website and are prepared by our transcribing team, Retta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logos, and Skylar Park. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all our social media accounts, our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.